This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I am at the bottom of the hour. I have a very special guest, and I'm looking forward to talking to him. And Christopher Zaida has written a memoir, a very heartbreaking and heart-wrenching memoir that I'm sure you will want to hear about, and it's called The Storm. And it's really quite amazing. But first, we're going to turn to Bill Larson, because I have been getting questions from so many of you out there. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Okay, well, Bill Larson is he's our legal eagle here. And I'm so happy that you're on today, because I got a funny letter that I need to ask you about. And so many of the listeners, you know, it's like a relentless thing for them. They get these letters and emails from all sorts of scam people, and they don't know where to go. And then the other day, just, you know, I'm preparing for the show, and I get this letter, and it looks very official, and I send you a copy, and this person says that I'm infringing on photographs that I've done. But all the photographs I use on my site are either sent to me directly by the publisher, or the publicist, or sometimes the author, if they're indie authors. So, you know, they've given me the right, obviously, right? And the other ones I use are from Unsplash, which is also supposed to be free. You think I'm safe? Did you look at that one? They want some Bitcoin money.
Yeah. So that's a giveaway right there when they ask for Bitcoin money.
Yeah. I didn't think.
So you know that's a scam.
Yeah, I didn't think that it was, but it looks, you know, it looks very official. And people who don't know, I mean, it says that they're lawyers and that it looks legal, and they really threaten you.
Yes, and they do a good job to make it look legal. But if you go to the Arden Fox website, you'll see that the lawyer listed on that letter does not work there.
Yeah. So,
do your due diligence.
Of course, and that's the problem. But there's also a danger. You don't want to click on these things, even. You don't want.
No.
You don't want any interaction whatsoever with these people.
No, we call it a no touch.
Exactly. So I got this, and all of you people out there, I know that you're getting a lot of these things. Just do not touch them. Don't open them. Don't respond. And certainly, if you have some Bitcoins hanging around, don't send it to them, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
But going back to your comment that publishers or authors send you photographs and you put them on your site, you have to make sure that the folks that send you the picture have rights in that photograph before you put it on your website.
Well, I hope that, you know, one of those very big ones, Penguin or Random House, they get me in trouble. They send me one that I can sue them, right?
No,
I can't. Well, I hope that I would think that generally speaking, these big publishers are aware of this kind of thing, right?
So I just defended a case in a photograph on a website.
Oh, tell us about it.
Okay, so the client found a picture on the web and sent it to one of their clients to use, and then they got sued by the photographer.
No.
Yep.
And this was, I mean, they were like the real companies, real publishers, real,
yes,
real people.
Yes, and they have some web guys that run the website who are not too up on copyright law and don't understand that you can't just take photographs and put them on the website. And they did, and they got caught, and they had to pay.
Oh, boy. This is scary. So what, should you get... I mean, like, as I said, I deal a lot with publicists, and they send me pictures of their, you know, cover art and pictures of the client, you know, their client, the author. Should I just assume they're okay, or do I have to ask for a permit?
you should have an assurance that they have rights in the photograph that, and that you can republish them.
Okay, well, everything, and you, it was a real lawsuit. Oh, my goodness, this is what's scary. Sometimes you think that it couldn't really happen, but it does.
Yeah, I defend several a year on these photographs.
Okay, well, I think that's the problem. Now, I know, I knew when I first started the program, there was a woman who, she had just taken every photograph she ever saw on the web and put it on her, you know, she had like 400 photographs on her blog to illustrate her blog. You know, so if she was talking about coffee, she would take a image of a coffee cup and a coffee, you know, canister and all sorts of things like that. And those were not, you know, those were from the actual owners, you know, the companies. And I know she got in a lot of trouble and she had 400 images and it took her forever to, you know, clean up her blog.
Right. So before you put an image on your website, make sure that you have the right to do so.
Okay. Well, that brings us to the next question then. Now, a lot of authors, and I'm talking indie authors, they are, you know, for their cover art, they are going to different companies or to people who advertise that they do illustrations for book covers. And there are so many. You get an author will get, you know, a half dozen a week saying, you know, I will illustrate your book cover. Now,
yes.
I know I sent to you some details where a company called Fiverr, which is very popular, many people use them, and they have different price structures. And among the price structures, they say that they will give you source codes. And for other, many people, I had a fight with an illustrator once, so I know that with an illustrator, though, if you tell them what you want on in the you know cover, if you tell them the like you want a bike or you want a certain kind of a dog with a patch on one eye and a tail that's white, how much of that belongs to you and how much belongs to the artist?
Nothing belongs to you and everything belongs to the artist.
Oh. So if you want
because
to
it's
do
the person that puts the pen to paper, the paintbrush to paper, that is the copyright owner.
Forever.
Not the person who gives them an idea.
So for example, we have a story and you have a particular dog and the dog has one white eye, a white tail, and you know, one white paw. Okay. Now this is your character. This is your dog in your story. It is your particular dog. Okay, we'll call him Patches. Now, he's got all these different white spots in specific places. That is your dream of your character, your dog character.
Yes.
If you hire somebody to do that dog for book one in your series, you are stuck with that person forever?
No. What you do is you need to get a copyright assignment in the drawing or the illustration. So that the author owns all the rights. And then if that person doesn't want to do any further illustrations, you can go to another illustrator and have them do it.
But the first artist has the right to that, can say, you know, they...
And that's why you need a copyright assignment. So whenever you work with an illustrator, you get a copyright assignment and the illustration.
And then
you own it.
And then you own it.
And you own it, yeah. So it's a transfer of the copyright. But absent a written... copyright assignment, then the copyright ownership stays with the illustrator.
So let's put this. They've drawn this dog. You like the look of this dog. The next illustrator comes along. They can't copy that exact dog, or they can copy that exact dog. I mean, they can cut and paste it if they wanted to.
Only if the author has the copyright.
Only if the author has a copyright.
Right. So when you work with your illustrator, you can go on Google and type in copyright assignment. There's a million of them there. You can just download them and get your author to have that signed by the illustrator.
And nowadays when they're talking about, you know, all the things that, for example, like source codes and all that, is any of that important?
Yeah, you want to get all of the different types of files that you can get from the illustrator for reproduction.
So if they've done it in Photoshop, for example, they have Photoshop files. Those files belong to you if you have paid for the copyright?
No, because the files and the copyright are two different things. The files are considered like a physical object that the illustrator owns. But once the copyright is assigned, which is an intangible right, it's the right to reproduce the illustration, then the author can reuse those illustrations. And even though the artist owns the files, the artist can't do anything with the files except keep them personally.
Okay, but for example, in Photoshop, you have like a PNG, you know, file, or you have the Photoshop file. Now, should you insist that you have that, you be given that?
Yeah, you want to get those files so you can reproduce it and then get the illustrator to sign a copyright assignment.
Because if you don't, then you are stuck with this illustrator forever, even if perhaps you didn't like the way the illustrator talked to you or how long it took the illustrator, because sometimes an illustrator will say, I can have a turnaround in, you know, 1 week, and actually they just drag it out for a month, and you don't want to deal the next time with somebody who's going to drag it out for a month.
So you could have a falling out for a number of reasons, and that's why you want to be the owner of the copyright. And the way that's done is with a copyright assignment.
And to make sure that you have the actual files, because it's...
makes it easier.
Yeah.
But with a little bit of technology, I could take an illustration on a piece of paper and convert it to digital in seconds.
But it would be... It'd
be just as good.
It would be just as good. Well, or you might just... You know, like Fiverr says that they give you those files. So maybe this is something that you have to... organize right when you get the, you know, start working with an illustrator.
Exactly. You want to spell out that you're going to have the copyright assigned, you want to have the amount of money that you're going to pay, and you want to have the milestones for delivery of the product.
Okay, now,
illustration.
Once the cover, it's your cover, and you own the copyright, that cover can be, you can...
Take it to any illustrator and have it redone.
And also it can be, now, you know, having worked in commercials and some film and stuff where we were filming in people's houses, we often had to cover, you know, put phony covers on books because we couldn't take, it was very funny. If we were shooting, I remember one segment in this house that had beautiful books all over the place. And we had to make up, that was one of the things I did. I had to make and produce phony covers for all of these books.
Yeah, that's a little overkill because they don't really have a copyright in the title of the book. But with
the ones with the pictures,
right? They could be copyrighted, so you can't use those in your film unless it's a fair use documentary or news.
Yeah. Okay. See, it wasn't, and I know we didn't have the rights, and it was too much trouble. You know, when you have like you have a murder, and you have somebody's, you know, head flopping down on a desk full of blood, and you have some books there. You have to make sure that they're not copyrighted books, right?
Well, it's okay if you put the spine of the book in just the title, that's fine.
Yeah, but not the contents, not the illustration on the cover.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, see, this is the thing.
The quirky parts of copyright law.
It is, and of course, it's, you know, why people need. To really, you know, authors have so many things they have to think about. And really, the last thing when they're writing and they're creating and they're having so much fun writing, they don't realize all of the things that go into it after you finish, you know, typing the last page. Now,
a simple fix. Just get in a copyright assignment off the internet.
And recently, in the recent years now, I understand that more and more authors are actually running their books past lawyers, to copyright lawyers, to ensure that they don't have anything in that book that's inappropriate.
Correct.
Do you do that? Are you Have you thought about doing that? You do?
Yeah, I do. I review and edit.
So is it mostly, you know, nonfiction, or do you also find
fiction? Most of mine are technical stuff.
Technical stuff. And you want to make sure that it doesn't. But also the problem nowadays, you have to be careful of everything you say in a book. You know, people are very sensitive to things. So there is this. And I think particularly if you are writing you know, a story that might reflect on real people, there's a question about how much you can say and what you can write.
You have to change the names to protect the innocent.
So, you know, this is a complicated world. And one of the things, as I said, authors are getting these things from Hollywood all the time, saying that they're going to take their book, and this is mostly, you know, indie authors get just inundated with these, you know, all sorts of proposals on, we love your book, we read your book, or send us your book, and we will turn it into a screenplay, and then we will give it to a Hollywood producer, and then you'll become rich and famous. That's not generally how it goes, right?
So you want to get a copyright lawyer to look over those contracts.
Yeah, you should never sign any. You should just never give your material to somebody you don't know.
Correct.
When you look at this is a good example. Lee Child was on the program a month ago. It was his birthday, and it was really wonderful. He came on the program, and we were talking, and he's been on the program before, and as you know, of course, he wrote the Jack Reacher books, and he just finished the 25th book, and he's retiring and turning it over to his brother. but when he did his deal with Tom Cruise to make the Jack Reacher movies, he obviously had a very good lawyer, because he somehow managed to keep the rights that he could take Jack Reacher back. And at that time, there wasn't streaming video, wasn't popular then. Nobody really knew about, you know, what was going to happen with all the Netflix and all of this. And so he was very, very, he must have had a great lawyer, because now, of course, he's taken the rights back from Tom Cruise. And now it's going to be a major streaming video series. But
and so that's why copyright lawyers are good, because they can kind of see into the future, and they know the things that can happen, and they'll write those into your contracts for you.
Because for most people, nobody ever knew really that Audible books were going to take off. I mean, when you think about it, 20 years ago, nobody thought about Audible books. And
no.
But a good lawyer, and obviously with, you know, Lee Child had a good lawyer. He was smart, because he had television experience in England. He had worked in television. So I think he, you know, was smart enough to know that something might happen in the future, that he could get the rights back. Because once you sell something like to Tom Cruise, it's not easy to get it back.
Right. And so they had a good lawyer that wrote that into the contract to preserve those rights. One of the issues they have with the television shows is on spinoffs, and there was a big lawsuit recently about whether a spinoff was covered in a copyright contract.
And is it?
It depends on what the contract says, and this contract was a little bit vague, and there was a big fight over it.
And so now when you work, you know, with an author, and you're going to have, you know, talk about rights, there are things that could happen in the future. People, we might have 3D, you know, characters walking around, and all of this has to be covered in a contract, correct?
That's right, and a good copyright lawyer knows what to put in there.
So do you try to imagine sometimes what in the world the future is going to bring? What are they going to be doing when we go to Mars?
And I do that every time I write a contract. I have to look into the future and say, what could go bad?
And make sure that you protect the authors, because authors, you know, they work so hard to come out with characters or to come out with their story, and then to find that somebody's taken it from them. And
inventors are the same, and artists and musicians and anybody that is very creative and has something good is going to get counterfeited, infringed, ripped off, plagiarized.
Oh, wow. So how are you doing in this pandemic-y period of our lives?
It was a big change in the law firm because everybody works from home now. It's just my wife, Mickey, and me here at the office.
Well,
and so there was a little bit of a curve to get used to the change, but we worked it out.
Well, we hope that it's getting better and that we can start again having people around because you have beautiful offices. And I know that that once this is over, people, you know, authors can call you and set up an appointment and meet with you. And particularly if and one of the things that a lot of these scams are, well, you know, you don't know. And that's why I'm telling authors that they really, when they get something, or sometimes in the form of a contest, they will enter a contest over the internet and they will be told that they're a winner and that they should then, you know, start signing contracts or signing papers. And even saying over the internet, you should not respond saying, yes, I agree to this, correct?
Correct. Yeah, it's just a spider's web.
Yeah, it's just one thing leads to another. You never do that. You have to really, people, you know, and this I know is happening, that people think that they've won a contest. And generally speaking, I having worked in Hollywood, I can tell you that's not the way.
One of the biggest scams is that you have, a person will call you up and say, you've won the lottery in Canada, and in order for me to process the winnings for you, I need $5,000 to pay the taxes and transfer you the money. You send them the money and it's gone.
Oh, yeah. And I always think, you know, well, you know, I was young and stupid when I worked with an illustrator, and she was my best friend at the time, and I didn't have an agreement, and the book has never been done yet.
So even lawyers get scammed.
Yeah, yeah.
They had a scam where foreigners would tell a lawyer, here, we're going to send you $100,000. You keep $30,000 of it and send $70,000 to this other person to complete this contract. And they would do that, and they'd send the $70,000, and found out that it was a scam, and their check bounces.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's why people need a good lawyer. And Bill Larson of Larson and Larson, right here in our area, in this now office that is a beautiful office, which I'm sure in a few months you'll all be back to business again. But they can call you, right, or contact you. What's the best way?
LarsonPatentLaw.com on my website.
Okay. Well, go to Larson.
All the information's there.
Yeah, it's all there. LarsonPatentLaw.com. Bill is my intellectual property lawyer, and he's also my patent lawyer, and he knows. And you are a member of, tell everybody, you are a member of what organization? And all the time, if you are working with a intellectual property, the lawyer must be a member of.
Well, it's called the AIPLA.
Yeah,
and that's a great resource for intellectual property attorneys.
Exactly. Do not use your real estate lawyer. Do not use your family lawyer. Do not use, like I did one time, a kid just out of law school. As a matter of fact, UCLA law school. And I'm going to be talking to somebody from Los Angeles in a few minutes. And so never use a kid who just graduated and just got through the bar, correct?
It's okay if you usually want to have a mentor.
Yeah, and you want somebody who knows and is a member of AIPLA.
In most law firms, we don't let the young attorneys talk to clients for several years.
Yeah.
They can sit in and help and stuff. But it takes, the apprenticeship is usually about 5 years.
Okay.
Until you're a real lawyer.
Bill Larson has all the experience you need, people. Contact Bill Larson for any of your intellectual property questions. In any of your intellectual property questions. He's our legal eagle. And Bill, thank you so much for being here.
And my pleasure.
Merry Christmas to you. It's coming
Merry
up.
Christmas.
And we'll talk to you again in 2021, which is going to be a better year.
Around the corner.
Okay.
Looking forward to it.
Okay. Thanks so much, Bill.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye. Okay. Well, I am going to go straight into talking to my next guest because we'll skip the commercials, okay? I'm telling Big Ed in the control room, skip the commercials. I have a good guest here. I'm not going to keep him waiting. Christopher Zida has written a wonderful, and it's his writing is incredible. It's the book is called The Storm, One Voice from the AIDS Generation. And right here on the cover is a blurb from Michael D. Eisner, which is pretty good. Hi, Christopher.
Hi there. How are you doing today?
Okay, great. Well, it is.
It's great to be here.
It is an honor to talk to you. I had L.A. on my mind. I had to mention that I was just talking to, we have an intellectual property lawyer who comes on, and every time I talk to him, I think about L.A. because the reason I am here on the west coast of Florida instead of the west coast of California is that when I was young and naive, I was doing some work in Los Angeles, and I got involved in a lawsuit, and I hired a lawyer, just a young, enthusiastic lawyer, and I thought, okay, I'm going to be a winner, and I wasn't. So, so you don't fight Hollywood.
Oh, no.
Oh, you don't. Oh, you don't. But he was so nice. He was so sweet. And he believed in me. And he knew, you know, that I was in the right. It doesn't matter. Now, you know, when you have a kid, when I look back now, of course, at the time, he was mature to me. But now I look back and I think, oh, boy, anybody who's been in an L.A. lawyer's office, the big ones, the big guys, after that, you know, you're a loser.
Oh.
Well, talk about some. You are, you know, well, your book, of course, reminds me so much about Los Angeles and some of the time I spent there. And the entire story is, we'll get into that. But I just sort of, I've been, as I was driving, I was thinking, my gosh, oh my gosh. He was the chief investment officer for Disney. And $4 billion, I was trying to picture $4 billion, all those zeros in my head. It was a nice drive. I was enjoying that. I was thinking, boy, oh boy, Christopher Zida was looking at balance sheets with $4 billion, and I'm looking at balance sheets with four digits. You know, it's pretty great, isn't it? Life is, you know, it throws you curves, but there are so many things. You've suffered such enormous tragedies. You've gone through so many things, but you started off to be a writer, and you have certainly turned into a major writer. And as I was reading this book, I said to myself, okay, I know this is a memoir, and it's so well done, so beautifully written. And I thought,
thank you.
I know that once you have this, once you get this first book out of, I'm sure you're going to be writing a novel after this.
We shall see.
Uh-huh.
I'm just glad that I got one done in my life.
Well,
but that's very kind of you to say that. That's a possibility. I really, that means a lot to me.
Well, because you just have a wonderful style of telling us, telling the stories, making us feel, you know, in each situation that you put us into, we can see it, we can feel it, we ache for you in the sad parts, we're happy for you in the good parts, you know, and it's just, this is great writing. When I talk about joy on paper, it's knowing that your words, they start making sense, and isn't it almost magical?
It is really it was a magical experience for me, actually, to write it. It was a very emotional, draining, cathartic, but also magical experience for me personally to write this book, because it was such a painful part of my life that I finally went back and addressed.
Well, that's what I felt, and I felt that I could feel, you know, I knew that it's terribly painful, but it's an important story, And you don't want these kind of stories forgotten. You don't want them, you know, just to disappear. As somebody who's doing, I'm doing research on a story in, set in the 1870s. And I so appreciate everybody, every person who wrote a diary, every person who wrote a memoir, every, because now I can go back and live in that time. And the same with this. I'll let you explain the story, you know, lay the foundation for it, but then I want to tell people why I think they should be reading this book.
Sure. Okay. Well, the story is it's a love story about me and my first partner, Stephen, who I met when I was a senior at college in UCLA, and this was in January of 1984. So this was in the very, very early days of AIDS crisis. And our love story, as we built our life together in the face of AIDS, you know, striking down our friends, and ultimately Stephen came down with AIDS and ultimately died, and some of the difficult choices that I had to make for my career, because I had started out as a writer so that I could make money to cover his health expenses and eventually, you know, hopefully, you know, I'd planned for my own too. And the crazy turn of my life took on a career perspective as I was battling insurance companies and doctors and families, really the whole world, with Stephen to get him through the end of his life and build a career, and how my career just exploded. And I ended up at the end, after I lost him, you know, slowly rebuilding my life and getting back to a place where life was happy and wonderful. And it was a story that I wasn't sure anyone would be interested in, but a couple of my friends really worked on me to write this book, and I finally got the courage to tackle it in late 2017.
Well, as I said, I think it's an important story, and you tell the background of how the sort of AIDS epidemic started, what we knew about it at the time, what we didn't know about it, the misconceptions, all of the things that were involved in it, and of course the insurance part that you write about, and how you know most people, when they go out to get a job to, you know, help pay for insurance, they don't land up with the kind of doing the kind of work that you did. It's really that story alone, the story of becoming a chief investment officer for Disney, and then later on doing the work for Amazon, and all of this fantastic financial work, which you didn't expect to do when you were back there in L.A., you know, going to school to be a writer.
No, I was an English literature major, and finance was really not on the radar screen for me. And one of the interesting things about my life is that after I made this very difficult decision to leave my writing career behind me and go get an MBA in finance, I did get hired by the Walt Disney Company, and I got put into the best finance group of the entire company, and I had incredible work experience and high-profile exposure with the senior executives, and it led me down this incredible finance career, ultimately to joining Amazon.com at the very beginning of the company, practically. And everything since then. I mean, I've had enormous strokes of luck in my life. I'm very enormously thankful for all of them. But I did, the backdrop of this was all happening as I was losing my first partner and trying to keep it all together and fighting doctors and insurance companies and just getting him the care that he needed and you know, crazy parents and everything in between.
Well, and as I said, just what makes a book like this fascinating and a page turner is this ability to take us to a place to tell us, whether it's telling about some of the times in the hospital or about the parents or just a simple story. You know, when I read that story about taking Stephen out to dinner at Lowry's, the prime rib.
Yeah.
That the way you write it. And it was at that point, and I think it's sort of midway through the book, and I think it was that story, and I stopped. I remember I was reading it, and I'll let you explain the story. At that point, I said, someday, Christopher Zaida is going to be writing a great novel. So tell us about that story.
Wow. Thank you so much for that wonderful compliment. Well, This was, as Stephen got sicker and sicker, at one point some of our friends started to drop us, and we were losing, you know, several friendships that he had had for a long time, a couple that I had had for a long time, and it was a crazy byproduct of AIDS in the 1980s, where, you know, people just sort of stepped back, and they didn't want to see you, and they didn't call you, you know, sort, because it was a scary thing for everybody, really. And we went to Laurie's Prime Rib restaurant one night, and he was on AIDS medicines, and they did give him nausea, and he vomited on the table in the middle of this restaurant. It was a big, open
and I know that
room.
Restaurant very well.
And we were in a booth, and he just, before I could get my little plastic bag out of my pocket that I always carried with me, he threw up, and nobody saw it, but the waiter saw it. And he came over and right away, and I just said, go get some gloves and let's clean this up. And he said, don't worry, I've got this. And he came over, he cleaned everything up, and he helped us out of the restaurant, and he comped the bill. And we didn't even know this person, and he was so nice. And when our, you know, the backdrop was that some of our friends that we thought would be there for us were stepping away.
And that's why, as I said, I got to that page, and there's many emotional parts before that. And then when I read that, the way you wrote it, so simply, so beautifully, and I got tears in my eyes, I said, I just stopped and I said, this is the beginning of a great novelist.
Wow.
Because
thank you so
to create that scene, it's short, and this is what's beautiful, how you can take a few paragraphs and tell a story and make it come alive. This is beautiful writing. And it was, as you say, it was wonderful to know that a stranger who just helped you just cared enough. And there were other strangers, too, and I thought that was very important that you wrote that about other people who came forward and stepped forward for you.
Yes. I mean, it was all part of my journey of growing up and coming of age, which is another major theme in my memoir. When I started to write it, I really wanted to just remember what had happened, because I had spent 26 years not thinking about it and really just moving beyond, and I wasn't sure I would remember it in any great detail to write a book at first. And so my book goes roughly chronologically through the whole period. It has a couple of flashbacks, but roughly chronologically. And every time I was just examining, what was I thinking? What was really going on in my life? What was going on with my family? What was going on in the world in Los Angeles and with AIDS? You know, what songs were playing on the radio? And it all really helped me remember. So, and I was very surprised at the end of it, how many details I really did remember, because it was really, when I started writing, I was afraid I wouldn't remember it.
Oh, and you remembered. And you remembered in a way that a great writer remembers. You remember it as a storyline, as being able to put it together. Whether it's talking about, as you said, about the parents and the very emotional times that you had with your own parents, with Stephen's, with your sister, all of these individual stories are so well done, and this is a memoir, and memoirs, and particularly as you say, this is a difficult subject is difficult, and people will think, well, I don't know if I want to know about it, but yes, there's so many reasons to read this book. First of all, any author out there who is writing in the 80s, about, you know, setting their story in the 80s, they will benefit from this book, because you have, for somebody who thought he couldn't remember details, you remember details and you make them come alive. Whether it's talking about, you know, people who, so many famous people who died of AIDS, or just the setting of Los Angeles that you described so beautifully. Authors, if you're out there and you're going to set your mystery story or your, you know, love story, whatever, in the 80s, you'll want to read this book. And then anybody who just wants to believe that there is goodness in this world. And also that you can do amazing things. And because if somebody who's, you know, studying to be, you know, going through, you know, UCLA to be a writer can turn out to be like it blows my mind. As I'm telling you, as I was driving, and I kept, I mean, I know what $4 billion looks like zero ways. But he had this kind of money to, well, not to run around with, but I mean, you were investing for Disney. I mean, like, I could invest for Disney. Like, it's beautiful. It's a success story. It's also a great American success story. Are you still there? What happened? Oh, boy. Do you want to get... let's say... There he is. I didn't want to lose him. I wanted to finish this. Well, we lost you. Oh, wait. Okay, Christopher.
Somebody cut me off.
Oh, not us. We were all like, oh, what's happened? What's happened to Christopher? I was telling everyone that you are, you know, the story is important. It's an important story to know. I think it's an uplifting story. It shows that love can conquer so much. Goodness can conquer so much. And yeah. There are problems. You know, we have the problems now with this pandemic and all of this, and but we can overcome as you know, we did. We didn't overcome AIDS, but the success is incredible.
Right.
And then a person, just one person who's determined to make a success of himself can do it. And you certainly did. And I it's just such an honor to talk to you because I haven't.
Oh my
I don't,
gosh, thank you. It's an honor to talk to you on your show.
Well, you know, it's. I always love when I get an author who I know is going to be coming back because you're going to be coming back. It might take you another year or so because there is a novel in you. Because your writing is just too good. You cannot give it up. And right now, I'm telling you, you found that joy on paper, and you're not going to give it up, right? You have to promise me that, Christopher.
I promise.
Okay. And, oh, I wanted to talk about the Australia trip. There's so many things in this book I wanted to talk about. I don't have all that time because it's just the week before Christmas, and I have a Christmas story that I have to do. But, you know, actually, I would like to have you back on sometime to talk more about sort of the specifics in the book, if you would come back.
Absolutely. You just let me know when you want to do it. I'm happy to do that.
Okay. Well, Christopher Zeida, the name of the book is The Storm, One Voice from the AIDS Generation. And do you have a website or a Facebook page you want people to go to?
I have there's a website, www.czeida.com is my author website.
Okay. Well, Zeida is spelled Z-Y-D-A, and again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you, Patsy. It was great to speak with you this morning.
Okay, and I'm going to be talking to you again soon. I'm not giving up.
All right.
Once I find
wonderful.
Once I find a great writer, I can't stop talking to him. Okay?
Oh, thank you so much. You've made my day.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right.
Now.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay. Wow. Remarkable story and remarkable person. Think of that. I got this $4 billion in my mind. But right now I have Rita Moreau on the phone. Hi, Rita.
Hey, Patsy. How are you?
Okay. Well, you know, we are getting ready for Christmas. And
yeah.
Do you have a tree up?
Actually, I have two up.
Two of them?
Two little ones.
Okay.
One's a little bigger than the other one.
Okay. Well, we're getting ready for Christmas, and I wanted to give some recommendations for books that will put us in a good mood. And I think you have something for us today, right?
I do.
So give us your book buzz.
Okay. Here we go. Okay. And this is a wowzer. So listen up. All right, this is the time of the year that we need heartwarming stories. So make the cocoa and get in your comfy chair. I have three novellas that will keep you warm and cozy. Christmas short stories featuring none other than Tasha Alexander's beloved Victorian sleuth, Lady Emily and her husband, Colin. So the first is Upon the Midnight Clear, where a clue in a Christmas cracker leads to a true holiday miracle. While most of London society has fled to their country estates for the holidays, Lady Emily and her family are enjoying a few days in the city. On a shopping trip to Hamley's toy shop, a kind-hearted stranger gives Emily's son a Christmas cracker. But when he opens it to reveal a cryptic clue inside, Emily suspects there's more to the gift than Christmas cheer. As Colin and Emily trace the clues through the city's snowy streets, more mysterious crackers arrive to guide their investigation. But who is sending them? What do they mean? Upon the Midnight Clear is a real page-turner. Next is That Silent Night. 'Tis the season for murder, mayhem, and mistletoe. And no one does it better than New York Times best-selling author Tasha Alexander. Once more, Lady Emily, Victoria's London's most colorful and delightfully eccentric sleuth, finds herself in the center of another strange mystery. When Lady Emily looks out at a snowstorm that is turning London white, she sees a woman standing in the blowing snow without a coat. An eerie feeling falls over her, and she rushes out to help, only to find that the woman has disappeared. Colin is convinced her eyes were playing tricks on her, but Emily won't be put off. Something spooky afoot, and she is determined to get to the bottom of it, even if it kills her. That Silent Night is a delicious morsel of a mystery with an irresistible ghost story at its heart. Finally, Amid the Winter Snow is an uplifting Christmas story that proves the enduring power of love. Emily and Colin are looking forward to nothing more than spending a relaxing Christmas at their country estate, eating mince pies and playing with their sons in the falling snow. Their solitude is interrupted by a knock on the door one night, when the villagers come to them with strange tales of a mythical black dog with red eyes and enormous teeth and claws that has been wreaking havoc on the town. Never one to be taken by local superstitions, Colin and Emily team up to find an explanation behind the bizarre events. Racing across the windswept and candlelit streets, the couple must follow the clues and uncover the truth to restore Christmas cheer. Tasha Alexander's Christmas novellas are just what you need to put you in good cheer this holiday. I've got mine loaded up on my Kindle. Upon the Midnight Clear, That Silent Night, and Amid the Winter Snow are available on Amazon for just $1.99 each. What are you waiting for? Grab that hot chocolate and hop to it.
Okay, Rita, thank you so much. And
you're right.
They are wonderful, and they do put you in a great mood. And for me, you know, I spent quite a few Christmases in England, and it was wonderful. As a matter of fact, on yesterday was Jane Austen's birthday, and I know that I was on Jane. I went on her birthday. As I mentioned before, I bought a cottage in England, not far from where Jane was born, and I spent an entire day of her birthday right there at her home. And, you know, in that area, I walked around. I actually had a picnic. And so it brought me back to those wonderful, wonderful times that I spent in England. And some great, oh, did I have some, go to a lot of wonderful restaurants in England at Christmas time. And talk about plum pudding. There's a lot of great food. And of course, shopping in Harrods was one of the joys of living in England at Christmas. Yep. But even the biggest joy was the day after New Year's, when we had the real white sale there. And I used to go shopping. And one year, I was in Harrods at this big sale, and I wanted to try on a pair of shoes, and I pulled off my boot because it was winter. It's January. It was freezing outside. Pulled off my boot to try on a pair of shoes. Bargain sale. Somebody grabbed my boot and walked off
no.
with it.
Oh, no.
Right there in the middle of Harrods, and I landed up having to buy. Well, I said to my husband, I had no choice. I had to buy more.
I had to.
I'd buy new boots, a few more shoes. Well, you know, it's a Harrods sale. So that was the wonderful, wonderful memories of England. And
Wow.
So anyway, thank you so much. I know
everybody
will enjoy
these. Invite
me
back anytime.
And these novellas by Tasha Alexander are wonderful. And I will have them up on my website so people can go and click and go ahead and get them. And order at Barnes & Noble and Amazon, wherever books are sold. Make sure that you just get yourself in a good Christmas mood, right? We need it.
Right. Absolutely. We need that. So our hot chocolate and our Kindle and Tasha Alexander's novellas.
Exactly. Thank you so much, Rita. Bye-bye now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. Okay. Well, it's always fun to have Rita here. Oh, well, not here in the studio. I love to have her here in the studio. Unfortunately, we're still doing this thing. And I actually remembered to take my mask off before I started the program today. Anyway, so what do I have things coming up? Christmas is coming up. I've got some really great things next week. Oh, I've got a real treat. Davon Miller is going to be reading some of his books for... We're getting ready for Christmas, so he's written a series of Mr. Tickety-Tock Clock books, and so we're going to have a little bit of reading from Davon Miller, and it's just so wonderful to start getting in this holiday mood. I was actually in Publix, and people were looking pretty sour, and then a song came on, and I started singing out loud. I think we're all sort of going a little bit cuckoo. I'm singing out loud in Publix, Silver Bells. And, it's funny. The minute I started singing out loud, the people around me, and, there's social distance and everybody's miserable. You can't see if people are smiling with their lips, but they started sort of looking like they were smiling. And I thought, what the heck? Why not, make a They can't see. They don't know who I am. I'm in a mask, I'm the Lone Ranger. Who knows? But you can start singing. Maybe that's one of the things with this stupid mask. Okay, everybody, remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture or a streaming video or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry. You never know and you won't know unless you start writing. So just start writing like crazy, 1,000 words a day. Ooh, that would be nice. And you'll have a novel in no time at all. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody. I'll say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. We managed to do it. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. Bye-bye, everyone.